My name is Optimus Prime. Now that I am stuck here on this planet you call Earth, I listen to Inside Movies and TV.
From Toronto, Canada, home of igloos, polar bears, and flying hockey pucks, this is Inside Movies and TV.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are tonight's entertainment.
Hello there, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Inside Movies and TV for the second last week in July of 2009. This is show number 64, and my name is Aaron Shaw, and on the other microphone is the other guy that does this show, Jamie Hosking. How are you doing,
my Hello friend? There. I'm very, very good, thank you. I'm a little hopped up with caffeine today, so you'll have to forgive me if I sound a little jittery or a little, little fast. Yeah. I'm drinking water now to try and flush all that coffee out of my system so I'm not all hopped up on goofballs, as they call it.
Hopped up on goofballs. Mm-hmm. Well, it's been another busy week for the world of entertainment, and we've got a lot to go. A lot of casting news, a couple of record breakers, and another passing of a legendary figure in the entertainment industry. And I guess we'll just start diving right into it.
Yes, this one
we got lots to cover and not a lot of time to do it.
No, this is an unfortunate story. Walter Cronkite, who earned the accolade the most trusted man in America for his earnest and stalwart style as the anchorman of the CBS Evening News for nearly two decades, passed away last Friday. He was 92 years old. CBS Vice President Linda Mason said Cronkite died at 7:42 p.m. Eastern Standard Time after a long illness, with his family by his side. Cronkite, recruited by Edward R. Murrow himself from the United Press Wire Service, joined CBS News in 1950. He served as news anchor and managing editor of CBS Evening News from April 16, 1962 to March 6, 1981. Beginning 1937, his career spanned more than six decades in radio, print, and television. During a period of great national stress, like the one brought on by the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas on November 22, 1963, Cronkite's demeanor soothed a nation whose sense of reality had been threatened. With his pipe in hand and the manner like that of a kind relative, he was the authority figure the nation turned to for explanation and solace. He was often referred to by the media as Uncle Walter. At the height of his career, Cronkite was the only journalist included in U.S. News and World Report's Most Influential Decision Makers in America. He received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1981, the highest honor a civilian can attain, and a Peabody Award in 1980 for his unsurpassed skills and integrity in reporting the news. In 1985, he was inducted into the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame. When Cronkite joined CBS News, its nightly newscast was only 15 minutes long. On September 2, 1963, it became the country's first half-hour evening news show, debuting with Cronkite interviewing John F. Kennedy. When JFK was shot and killed roughly 2 months later, Cronkite calmed the nation with his humane, steadfast style. When Cronkite voiced objection to President Lyndon Johnson's Tet Offensive in the Vietnam War, it was a major setback for Johnson and his Vietnam policy. If we lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost Middle America, Johnson lamented. Cronkite closed each evening news newscast with the line, "And that's the way it is," followed by the date. Following his departure from CBS Evening News, he served as the correspondent for CBS Reports' Child of Apartheid, which won an Emmy and an Overseas Press Club Edward R. Murrow Award for Outstanding Documentary. He also produced and hosted an 8-part Discovery Channel series, Cronkite Remembers, which traced historical events of the 20th century. Ever a great champion of the network news division, Cronkite declared that the news should not be judged by a number-crunching profit fashion, as is the rest of network television. Walter Cronkite, dead at 92, he will certainly be greatly missed. So he's certainly a figure that I just kind of remember from my early childhood. He retired when I was just a young boy, and you don't remember him at all. You just know him by reputation.
Just by reputation,
yeah.
Yes.
He was You retired 2 years before you were born, you were saying.
Yeah, so. A couple years before I was born. Not that, you know, I don't feel America's pain. Okay, I don't, it's not that I don't understand it. I mean, well, and it's a name that, you know, somebody such as myself who was at one time considering journalism as a career, it's a name that pops up and he's in probably textbooks galore in terms of, well, he, even here, you've even said it, he spanned all three mediums. Radio, print, yeah. And TV.
And not only that, but American news coverage in the middle part and later part of the 20th century was, especially on television, was just dominated by a few sources. On TV, you had only three major networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS. So those three news anchors were the trusted news anchors for national news, and then you'd have local news. Now, there are so many news channels and different broadcasters involved that the audience is so splintered that it's hard to develop the kind of trust and just overall reputation that he developed when he was anchoring the news. So we won't see his kind again, I don't think.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on to some more current news. We have box office results in for this weekend. And to no surprise, we have a franchise topping off as the number one movie.
No surprise at all. And I know we talk about box office every week, but you know, these are numbers that can't be you know, missed. And of course, we're talking about Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. the sixth installment of the Harry Potter franchise has worked its charms in the North American theaters, as it sold an estimated $159.7 million worth of tickets during its first 5 days of release. But while Half-Blood Prince crushed its rivals at the box office, the Wizard Fantasy failed to match the performance of the year's biggest movie so far, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, which earned $201 million in its first 5 days last month. However, it did outpace its predecessor, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, which came out in 2007, whose five-day tally was $139.7 million. Order of the Phoenix ended up making $938 million worldwide, making it the seventh biggest movie of all time before accounting for inflation. There are only two films left in the franchise, whose first five films have generated $4.5 billion since 2001. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, which will be directed by, again, David Yates, will be rolled out in two parts, once in 2010, November 2010, and July of 2011. Of course, the movie came out on a Wednesday. Those are the five-day numbers. The traditional Friday through Sunday number saw Harry Potter earning $79.5 million, which is not that far ahead from the $77.1 million that Order of the Phoenix made. Overseas, big numbers as well. The movie opened at a commanding number one spot with $237 million in its first 5 days. That tally represents the biggest five-day opening launch overseas ever. The previous record holder was Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, whose five-day total was $218.4 million in 2007. I also wanted to point out that, The Half-Blood Prince didn't do the $200 million that Transformers did. It did clobber it for midnight screenings. There were the midnight screenings this week, which saw Harry Potter take in $22.2 million, which beat both Transformers and The Dark Knight.
Right. Now, you look at the numbers and you say, okay, it did $160 million in 5 days versus $201 million for Transformers. That's, you know, certainly nothing to sneeze at. Those are fantastic numbers. I'm going to say that Harry Potter will beat Transformers for the biggest movie of the year.
I would imagine it. I would not blame it. And you want to know why?
Quality.
Because people can go back and see Half-Blood Prince.
It's a better movie.
Nobody could see Transformers again.
Did we report, was it last week that Transformers dropped off, was it 50-some-odd percent? Was it?
Yeah, it dropped 58% or something like that.
Yeah, so you're not going to see, I don't think you're going to see that big of a drop-off for Harry Potter. I think the critical consensus was really, really good. You know, it was in the 90%. 95% range, I think, on Rotten Tomatoes, somewhere
it's,
around there.
It's dropped to 84.
Oh, it's dropped
now,
to 84.
Sadly.
Okay, but still, a lot better than Transformers. I think you're going to see Harry Potter fans going to see it again. You know, I'm one of the people who saw Transformers opening night, midnight showing, that sort of thing. I won't see it again. But, you know, Harry Potter will get repeat viewings again, I'm sure.
I wanted to say it isn't on IMAX yet. It's going to make IMAX numbers because it's coming out on IMAX July 29th, and that's because they shifted its release from last November to this July. Warner Brothers did because for lack of, you know, bottom line coverage this summer. So, but because they switched it from mid November to this mid July, that fell in the exclusive IMAX time that Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen has. So, July 29th, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince comes out on IMAX. It's going to probably make some good numbers there. I don't think I'm going to see it in IMAX because I was sitting so close to the screen opening night that I was pretty good. I was pretty
unfortunately,
satisfied.
Unfortunately, you guys had to sit really close. I think it's probably going to be the last blockbuster movie of the summer. As much as I want to see G.I. Joe for its camp factor, it's a B movie, let's face it.
Yeah, it's not going
to... It's the last blockbuster of the summer. I think the only thing that will hurt it in its race to be number one will be that it came out so kind of late in the summer.
Exactly, yeah.
But you know what? It's still got at least a full month before kids go back to school to earn that money. There's not a lot out there for kids to see. As far as family movies, there's not much coming out.
There's G-Force comes out next Friday or Friday after.
Unknown
I can't remember.
Right there. It's not.
That's the only movie that people are saying is going to drop Harry Potter.
Out of the number one spot.
But,
I don't think it will.
But between now and next Friday, I'm sure it'll gross $200 million.
Yeah, and
this is only $40 million.
I predict
difference.
That Harry Potter will stay in the number one spot for at least another week. I think G4 will, if anything, will debut in number two or maybe even lower than that. Okay, so let's move on to some actual finance numbers and some studio numbers.
As a result of Harry Potter.
Warner Brothers has joined Paramount in hitting the $1 billion mark in domestic gross this year. The studio made the announcement on Sunday after Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince grossed $160 million in its first 5 days. Warner says that reaching the $1 billion mark in 192 days is a record for the studio. Paramount reached the milestone on July 8th. Warner Brothers noted that seven of its films have led a weekend this year. The others are 17 Again, Friday the 13th, Gran Torino, The Hangover, He's Just Not That Into You, and Watchmen. Warner says it's hit the $1 billion domestic mark in 10 of the past 11 years, and it's the only studio to do so for 9 consecutive years. Mm-hmm. The studio's movie The Hangover has become the highest-grossing R-rated comedy ever at the domestic box office, with more than $235 million, breaking a record held by Beverly Hills Cop 25 years ago. So, Paramount Pictures reaching that number, that is obviously because of two movies right there. First of all, Star Trek, we already know, is a blatant Paramount release, but, you know, it's not immediately obvious to know that Transformers is technically distributed by Paramount, but it's a DreamWorks movie.
Yeah.
So,
and
that's...
Those two movies have raked in the big bucks for Paramount, I'm sure there's going to be a couple other studios that'll hit the $1 billion mark. We're on pace for a record summer again, third year in a row. Yeah. We're also on pace for another record box office year because nobody's doing anything else because of this recession.
Once again, though, the studio that seems to be kind of absent a little bit, I don't know, maybe absent, but didn't we have this kind of phenomenon last year where Universal Pictures didn't have a lot going on last
year? Yeah, Universal hasn't been in the game so much lately as in past years.
Which is really odd because it's an NBC... it's an NBC company, I guess. Well, I'm just on the website now, and I'm looking up their movies, and we're looking at movies like Bruno.
Oh God! I'm Bruno.
You know, Inglourious Bastards.
That's not out yet. Yeah, that's going to make some money for Universal.
It'll do all right, I think. Yeah. Public Enemies was one of their movies, of course. Land of the Lost. You know, they're not having a great summer, unfortunately.
Public Enemies isn't doing the numbers that it could do.
No, critically
it would have done better in November.
Yeah. They've got a good chance at a funny comedy coming up with Couples Retreat. They've got The Wolfman coming out.
Who's got funny people coming out? Is that Warner's or is that Universal?
I don't know who that is.
I think that's going to be another... kind of comedic hit this summer. Maybe. I don't know. I'm definitely interested in seeing it, and there's not too many comedies that I would like to see too often.
Oh, that is funny. No Funny People is theirs.
Is Universal?
It is Universal.
There we go. So they've got a couple movies coming later on in the year, and we'll keep an eye out on them for sure.
Yeah.
Now we're going to move on to some casting news. The first of many casting news, and this is kind of tangentially related to Harry Potter, as over the past year we've seen its new rival in the fantasy world rise in that of Twilight. And the casting news I'm talking about is that they've casted the first new actor for the third Twilight movie called Eclipse, and his name is Xavier Samuel. He's an unknown Australian actor who landed the part of Riley, according to Summit. Riley is a good-looking college student who joins the plot of villain Victoria to murder the protagonist Bella, who's played by Kristen Stewart. The character Riley is corrupted by Victoria, for whom he has an inexplicable weakness. The movie's larger plot centers on a choice Bella must make between the werewolf Jacob, played by Taylor Lautner, and the vampire Edward, played by the now famous Robert Pattinson, also a Harry Potter veteran. Samuel has been in a series of films down under, including Newcastle, in which he played a goth teenager amidst a group of surfers. He's also been in the Ozzy period drama September, and will be appearing in the upcoming sci-fi thriller Road Train. His landing the role of Riley in Eclipse marks his first U.S. role. Of course, Eclipse is the third book in the Stephanie Meyer's blockbuster series, and shooting on that film is set to begin in September. No, next month. So in August, in Vancouver, is going to be released on June 30th, 2010. It's going to be directed by David Slade, who did 30 Days of Night. And it's based on a screenplay by Melissa Rosenberg. And we should say that New Moon, the second Twilight movie, is coming out this November.
I think that's an interesting choice for director for the third movie, Eclipse. If anybody, you know, I know that there's a lot of cross-audience pollination. There may be older Twilight fans, but 30 Days of Night was a pretty vicious vampire movie. Very gory, very bloody. And
I didn't even get through the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't the greatest vampire movie, but it certainly had its, violent moments, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, we've got another big story here. We're going to dive into some TV news, and that is the Emmy nominations. It was a rather animated morning for Seth MacFarlane when they announced the nominations. His two-year gamble of putting Family Guy from animated series contention and submitting it for Best Comedy has paid off. The Primetime Emmy Awards announced their nominations, and the Fox hit Family Guy became the first animated series in nearly 50 years to get a comedy series nomination. MacFarlane said, "I think it's extremely encouraging for everyone who is busting their ass in these animated shows to have this happen. It's a huge step forward for open-mindedness in the voting process. Family Guy, one of the 10 best series finalists last year, might have been a beneficiary of the TV Academy's decision this year to expand the number of nominees in the main categories from 5 to 6 and have its entire membership vote in the top fields." TV historian Tim Brooks said, "It's a suggestion that the Academy voters are getting younger and appreciate the fact that animation has come of age and it's a genre worthy of respect. Until The Simpsons in the early 1990s, animation was perceived as a lesser genre. And it's hard to make that argument today."
Yeah, very hard.
With two ties, the Best Comedy and Drama Series categories ballooned to 7 nominations this year, inching closer to their feature brethren last month. The Best Picture Oscar category was expanded to 10 nominees. For the past 3 years, the 5 nominees in the top series and acting categories were determined by blue ribbon panels originally designed to boost the presence of more obscure series in those categories. But if by scrapping the panels this year and reverting to a popular vote, the Academy and the broadcast networks that carry the Emmy broadcasts were hoping that the big network shows would return to their dominance in the marquee categories, well, that didn't happen. In the comedy field, for instance, in addition to Family Guy, which became the second animated series to land a Best Comedy Series nomination, following the Flintstones in 1961, the biggest prize is the nomination of HBO's Flight of the Conchords, the offbeat show, barely known outside of the big cities, landed 2 major nominations, Best Series and Lead Actor in a Comedy Series for Jemaine Clement. The category also features the biggest infusion of fresh blood, with four of the seven nominees being first-timers: Family Guy, Concords, CBS's long-overlooked How I Met Your Mother, and Showtime veteran Weeds. In the top comedy category, How I Met Your Mother represents CBS's Monday comedy block, whose two leading shows, Chuck Lorre's three-time best series nominee Two and a Half Men, and the much-buzzed-about The Big Bang Theory, are among the most surprising omissions this year. Family Guy, How I Met Your Mother, both from 20th Century Fox Television, and Concords and Weeds will compete against defending champ 30 Rock, previous winner The Office, and three-time best series nominee Entourage. Last year's best series winner NBC's 30 Rock and AMC's Mad Men, again, are the most nominated shows with 22 and 16 nominations, respectively. 30 Rock's Hall of Nominations broke the record for most nominations for a comedy series.
Well, just how big is 30 Rock and Mad Men's dominance this year? Well, they landed four of the five writing nominations in the comedy and drama series categories. Mad Men creator Matthew Weiner landed the mentions for writing or co-writing all four nominated episodes. In the best drama category, Mad Men, the reigning champion at all major TV awards, faces two-time nominees AMC's Breaking Bad and HBO's Big Love, as well as FX's Damages, Showtime's Dexter, and only two network tentpole series, ABC's Resurgent Lost and Fox's House. One big snub was Alan Ball's critically and commercially successful vampire drama True Blood, which is seen on HBO, which didn't land any major nominations despite its star Anna Paquin being touted as a lead contender on the heels of her Golden Globe triumph in January. Also missing in action are top FX dramas The Shield, whose much-lauded final season failed to earn a single nomination. Also missing are Rescue Me, which only landed a guest-starring nomination for Michael J. Fox. The final seasons of two other long-running dramas, ER and Battlestar Galactica, were also largely overlooked. Among the networks, HBO again leads the pack, this time with 99 nominations, followed by NBC, with 67 nominations, ABC's 55 nominations, CBS's 49, and Fox's 42 nominations, respectively. A record three cable networks, HBO, Showtime, and AMC, have landed multiple Best Series nominations. For the lead actor and actress in the drama series, the field stayed status quo, with only one new face in each field, that being Simon Baker of CBS's hit The Mentalist and Elizabeth Moss for Mad Men. For the male category, last year's surprise winner Bryan Cranston is back, along with Hugh Laurie from House, who's won four nominations, who's had four nominations. Gabriel Byrne for In Treatment, Michael C. Hall for Dexter, and John Hamm of Mad Men. On the female side of the categories, Elizabeth Moss joined the five actresses nominated from last year, such as previous winner Glenn Close for Damages, Sally Field of Brothers and Sisters, and Mariska Hargitay, of Law & Order SVU, plus Kira Sedgwick of TNT's The Closer, and Holly Hunter, also of TNT, for Saving Grace. Big Bang Theory's Jim Parsons, who is one of the hottest comedy stars at the moment, landed his first awards nomination in the lead actor in a comedy series, where he will face off against last year's winner Alec Baldwin for 30 Rock, Steve Carell for The Office, Charlie Sheen of Two and a Half Men, plus three-time winner Tony Shalhoub for Monk, and Jemaine Clement of Flight of the Conchords. Toni Collette earned her first Emmy nomination for her multiple personality disorder-stricken heroine on Showtime's United States of Tara. In the lead actress in a comedy series, she's joined by two previous winners, they being Tina Fey for 30 Rock and Julia Louis-Dreyfus for The New Adventures of Old Christine. Also in that category is Sarah Silverman for The Sarah Silverman Program, Mary Louise Parker for Weeds, and Christina Applegate of ABC's recently canceled Samantha Who. And that's not the first time that the Emmys have, that an actress or an actor has been nominated for an Emmy after their show has been canceled. Only two projects made it into the ever-shrinking Best Miniseries category, and they are HBO's Iraq War drama General Kill and PBS's Little Dorrit. This is raising questions whether the category would continue or be folded into the TV movie field. Another Iraq-themed HBO drama, Taking Chance, will compete in the Best TV Movie field alongside two other politically tinged HBO films, one being the Winston Churchill-centered Into the Storm, and the Kennedy-themed Grey's Gardens, as well as Lifetime's biopic Coco Chanel, and the based-on-a-true-story Prayers for Bobby. With its 17 nominations, including those for stars Jessica Lange and Drew Barrymore, Grey Gardens tied the record for 1976's Eleanor and Franklin and 1977's Eleanor and Franklin, the White House years, for most nominations for a TV movie. It's a case of deja vu in the Best Reality Competition and Best Variety, Music, or Comedy Series categories, in which the nominees' lists are replicas of last year's fields, and in which the respective incumbents, the six-time winner The Amazing Race, and Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, try to extend their record streaks. In the reality competition, Amazing Race again will go against Fox's American Idol, ABC's Dancing with the Stars, and Bravo's Project Runway and Top Chef. In variety, musical, or comedy series, The Daily Show again competes with Comedy Central's The Colbert Report, CBS's Late Show with David Letterman, NBC's Saturday Night Live, and HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher. The 61st Primetime Emmy Awards will be held on September 20th at the Nokia Theater in Los Angeles and will be broadcast on CBS.
So certainly a lot of information there to digest. The things that stuck out for me, of course, were 30 Rock just getting, you know, a ton of nominations, and rightfully so. It's a fantastic show. I think it's starting to get to a point maybe where people are taking it a bit for granted. Kind of like The Office as well. It just kind of gets nominated because it's, you know, it's a high quality show and it always does well. Every time I see the show, all I can think of is that Alec Baldwin didn't want to do, you know, a second and third season because of all of his personal issues regarding custody of his child and that sort of thing. But he's outstanding in the show. And when it comes to the male nominations, I think you're going to see him take another Emmy win. If not, I think it could be a surprise win for Jim Parsons for The Big Bang Theory. I don't think Steve Carell is going to take it or anybody else like that. I unfortunately, you know, once again, I'm disappointed that Battlestar Galactica didn't get nominated. I figured with it being its final season, it might get at least a nomination, and it got snubbed again for major categories. That's really unfortunate. When you're looking over all this and all these nominations, what do you seeing? What are you feeling about what they've...
I like Family Guy.
You like Family Guy? Yeah, I think that's a big deal.
That is a big deal.
The
first show in over 50...
You can't
discount that, and you can't overlook the fact that The Simpsons in its prime was overlooked.
Yeah, and I think The Simpsons has paved the way for people to, you know, not think of it as an animated comedy, just think of it as a comedy.
You know, the Family Guy, it's getting funnier and funnier the more I watch it. Some of it's getting a little bit stale, but they are still continuously pushing the envelope. And, you know, kudos to Seth MacFarlane for being adamant that it comes as, that it's a comedy series, not just in the animated category. So that sticks out for me.
Yeah, he's been doing that the past couple of years. Instead of submitting the show in the animated category, he's been submitting it, and you can choose what you want to submit your shows for nominations. He's been submitting it in the comedy category, and only after 2 years, it's paid off for him.
Also, Christina Applegate for Samantha Who. The show's been canceled, and yet there she is up for an Emmy nomination. That could show maybe premature on the network's behalf. I'm trying to think in my head, because I had said it's not the first time that a show has been nominated for an Emmy after it's been canceled.
It happens all the time, yeah.
I'm sure the one that's sticking out in my head, I don't know, I want to say Star Trek, was it nominated for Emmys after it was canceled? Or for some reason, Just Shoot Me?
I'm not sure.
Just Shoot Me. Some saying Just Shoot Me might have been up for some Emmys.
Yeah, I think it does happen quite a bit. As far as the situation with Samantha Who goes, I don't think that that it had an audience big enough that it'll actually get an award for Christina Applegate. Let me see here. TV shows that were nominated after they were canceled. I'm sure there were...
While you're doing that, I'm just going to also mention HBO, showing that it's still the better type of better quality network. 99 nominations. which is far ahead of NBC with their 67. You know, I've seen plenty of HBO shows, and it goes without saying, those shows come with a budget and come with good acting. I'm thinking Sopranos, I'm thinking Rome, I'm thinking Carnival.
I think even Family Guy was nominated after it was canceled the first time.
Maybe that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, Matt TV was nominated, I believe, after it was canceled.
I'm just starting to get into Matt TV. I'm watching reruns now.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of TV shows, I'm sure, that fit that bill.
But things also that stick out for me are the fact that categories like male and female for the comedies, or those nominations are, no, sorry, dramas, those nominations are basically the same.
Yeah.
You know, says to me that...
Not a lot of deviation there.
There's not a lot of deviation. Now, part of that could be part of the writer's strike, because there wasn't a lot of new content out there available.
Not a lot of new shows that lasted after cancellation.
Exactly. And so I look forward to doing our follow-up on how this ends up.
It's funny, the shows that did last beyond cancellation kind of barely lasted. Mm. Fringe, I was kind of surprised that it picked up another year. So, I think the gift there is...
Fringe wasn't up for anything.
No, well, I think the gift there is you're just getting another year. You know, it was good enough to warrant another year, but certainly not good enough for any kind of big nominations, I don't think. But when you think about shows, new shows that are returning, I don't think any of them really warrant, awards. I think the tried and true, unfortunately, this year are the ones that have been on for a long time. One quick thing I wanted to mention in this whole Family Guy Simpsons category, Simpsons certainly did, I believe, pave the way for other animated series like Family Guy to get proper recognition. And the quality of The Simpsons, we're approaching 20 years now with The Simpsons. Morgan Spurlock is doing a documentary on 20 years of The Simpsons. It's going to be out in January on television, I believe. And right after they did The Simpsons feature film, I think the quality dipped a bit on the show. But this past season on The Simpsons has been hilarious.
Has it?
It really has.
I haven't been able to sit through for 10 years.
I mean, when they do those horrible flashback episodes where Homer's in a grunge band and crap, and they rewrite, I hate it when they rewrite history. The continuity of the show is completely out the window. But this past year has been really high quality, and I have laughed. They've gotten back to basics. And they've kind of gotten away from these convoluted shows. So hopefully someday we'll see The Simpsons be nominated in the category for best comedy TV show. Someday, I hope. Now that they see that Family Guy's done it, maybe they'll actually submit it in the comedy category instead of animated category.
Maybe.
All right, so we're going to move on to a little bit of more local news, but it has a worldwide audience, and that is the official announcement of the opening night slot and other films for the Toronto International Film Festival. They've given its plum opening night slot to a movie that isn't Canadian, which is causing some controversy. The opening night film is the Charles Darwin biopic Creation. It's a British film from director John Amiel, and the movie stars husband and wife Paul Bettany and Jennifer Connelly. Bettany portrays the 19th century British naturalist who conceived of the theory of evolution, and opposite his wife, Emma, played by Connolly. The choice is certainly causing a stir among the festival's opening news conference on last Tuesday, because the event, like I said, traditionally opens with a Canadian film to showcase local talent. The festival co-director Cameron Bailey said that Creation best fits the demands of the opening night slot because it promises to spur debate about faith and reason as it entertains. The festival is set for September 10th through to the 19th. They also announced the Gala World Premiere slots at Roy Thompson Hall for Get Low, Aaron Schneider's frontier drama that stars Robert Duvall, Bill Murray, and Sissy Spacek, and the romantic comedy The Invention of Lying from Ricky Gervais and Matthew Robinson.
I'm still seeing that movie.
Yeah, I know. It looks pretty funny. Warner Brothers is releasing that movie domestically September 25th. This is one of these things that kind of drives me a little nutty for during the festivals that some of the studio movies, they end up at the festival, but then they're out in theaters like a week later.
So here's the lowdown for Invention of Lying. Ricky Gervais plays Ricky Gervais.
yeah.
Basically. But he lives in this world, and it's not an alternate world or anything. It's just this world where nobody has ever lied. Everybody's honest and tells the truth, which is always a problem. It's okay to lie sometimes. And then for some reason, I can't remember what, just judging from the trailer, Ricky Gervais gets himself out of a jam by lying. And because nobody's ever lied, they take him for his word. And then he just goes on a rampage of lying and lying. And it just looks really, really hilarious.
I think Jennifer Garner's in this, too.
She is in this. Really good, yeah. And also noteworthy is Ricky Gervais, who never wanted to do movies, has done two movies coming out in 2 years theatrically. With last year was Ghost Town.
Right. So the film festival has been affected by tough times, just like almost everything has. Cuts to its operating budget, ticket pricing, and a new cost-sharing arrangement with the Canadian film distributors is taking place right now. Screenings at the Elgin Theatre, for example, will see ticket prices cut from $38.50 to $19.87, about half of those screenings. Weekends and evening shows will remain at the premium $38.50 ticket price.
Of course.
The festival greatly needs the added revenue to close a $49 million funding gap for Bell Lightbox. It's year-round headquarters that's under construction just around the corner from my office. It's at a cost of $196 million. It's this fantastic new building that's opening up on King Street in downtown Toronto. The festival this year will give donors of at least $250 the ability to order tickets before the general public based on the size of their gift. Donors of more than $5,000 jump to the head of the line.
Oh, yeah.
American donors to the Toronto Festival are eligible for a U.S. tax credit courtesy of a New York-based TIFF foundation. And Cameron Bailey said that giving Canadian and American donors preferential treatment will not detract from the event's reputation as the People's Festival. He said ordinary cinema-goers have lots of access and choices when buying tickets. The festival is going to make additional lineup announcements in the coming weeks. So the festival is something that either people love or kind of hate or ignore.
It always has its share of stories.
It's certainly concentrated in downtown Toronto, so if you want to avoid it, you certainly can. I've been to a couple of film festival flicks myself, and it's been a pretty interesting experience. It always depends on the lineup for me. I like some of the midnight showings where they'll schedule kind of avant-garde films, maybe horror films or science fiction films, things that don't get a huge audience but kind of have a younger audience. I like those movies. A couple of interesting movies that were at the film festival are movies like The Hurt Locker, which just came out in limited release a few weeks ago. You've seen it.
I loved it.
Premiered at the film festival last year, so almost a year later.
The Wrestler.
Yeah, The Wrestler.
Crash.
So there's a lot of mainstream movies, independent movies, foreign films, the whole gamut takes place.
Yeah, if you're opening, I think last year The Wrestler opened TIFF. I can't remember, but if you're getting showtime at the festival, critics are watching, and so are award voters, and of course the idea is for titles that don't have a distributor to be showcased, and the distributor bids and tries to distribute the movie. But as I said, some Academy Award movies, nominated movies, winners, losers, have all been showcased at TIFF. As I said, there, Crash, The Wrestler, what's that one? Eastern Promises, mm-hmm. So on and so forth.
Okay, so let's get into some casting news.
Yeah, and this is big news for Marvel Studios. As it's found its love interest for Thor, as they've tapped Natalie Portman to star opposite Chris Hemsworth for the comic book picture Thor. Portman will play an updated version of the Jane Foster character, who is a nurse who becomes Thor's first love. In the picture, the actions of Thor, who is an arrogant Norse warrior, reignites an ancient war, and as a result, he's cast down to Earth, where he is forced to live among humans as punishment. Once there, however, Thor learns what it takes to be a true hero when the most dangerous villain of his world sends the darkest forces of Asgard to invade Earth. Paramount's going to distribute the picture, which is being directed by Kenneth Branagh. It's going to be released May 20th, 2011, with production starting early in 2010. Marvel Studios' Kevin Feige is producing. Portman's involvement in the movie has been rumored for months, and she had long been the main contender for the female lead. Portman is currently shooting Universal's comedy Your Highness under the direction of David Gordon Green, She will also star in Darren Aronofsky's supernatural thriller Black Swan, and will next be seen in Jim Sheridan's Brothers opposite Jake Gyllenhaal and Tobey Maguire. Wow, I guess they're twins, obviously. She recently wrapped up production on Heischer, which is produced by... I'm not bothering with that one. Chris Hemsworth, who's got the lead for Thor, is the one who played Jim Kirk's father in Star Trek. That's where you saw him from. His performance in that 5-10 minutes is what got him the part of Thor.
That's pretty amazing.
And of course, this is part of Marvel's build up to the Avengers movies. There's rumor that Samuel L. Jackson's going to make his cameo as he did in Iron Man. If not, it's going to be Edward Norton or Robert Downey Jr.
And as for Natalie Portman, she certainly hasn't shied away from movies. Like, this isn't even her first comic book movie. She does, you know, she's mixed up serious roles and period pieces with, of course, roles in the Star Wars prequels and V for Vendetta, another comic book film.
Yep.
All right, so we've got more casting news. Willem Dafoe is actually going to star alongside Taylor Kitsch, another comic book star, and Lynn Collins, another comic book star, both of them in the Wolverine movie earlier this summer. They're going to be in John Carter of Mars, the Walt Disney picture fantasy epic to be directed by WALL-E director Andrew Stanton. Dafoe is going to play the role of Tars Tarkas, a fierce green Martian warrior who's unusual among his savage race for his ability to love. Aww. Tars developed an alliance with John Carter in the first film, which is based on A Princess of Mars. I believe Tars Tarkas has several arms, too, which will be interesting to see. He fights battles alongside Carter through the entire series of Edgar Rice Burroughs books, so he will be hanging around for sequels. Taylor Kitsch, who's coming off of The Bang Bang Club and the TV series Friday Night Lights, was set in June to play the title character, a damaged Civil War veteran who finds himself mysteriously transported to Mars. Lynn Collins, who acted alongside Kitsch in Wolverine, is going to play the Princess of Mars. I don't know about this one. It's going to be weird. It sounds like it's got a bit of an old Flash Gordon feel to it.
I was thinking something along that, yeah. Hmm. All right, more casting or rejoining casting news in this case, as CSI favorite Georgia Fox, who was last seen in a cameo in William Patterson's final episode in January, when their characters Sarah Seidel and Gil Grissom reunited in Costa Rica. Well, she's returning to the veteran crime drama. She is said to appear in 5 episodes of the series' upcoming 10th season, and of course she'll reprise her role as Sarah. As of right now, there are no immediate plans for Peterson, whose character had a romantic relationship with Sarah, to return for more episodes. CBS executives and CSI producers had said that they were looking to make significant creative changes on the show next season following a ratings slide following Peterson's departure. Peterson, of course, was replaced by Lawrence Fishburne. CSI Crime Scene Investigation will return with new episodes on September 24th. Georgia Fox, one of the show's original cast members, left during the 8th season when her character, who was suffering from a job burnout, decided to leave the crime lab to deal with past demons.
So that's certainly interesting news. I'm sure they'll have to explain, you know, why she's returning. The character's returning to the show, and she won't be a permanent part of the cast. I guess it's just like
a couple cameos.
Couple of cameos. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. We've got another story regarding an animated series. This is one that's been canceled, and then they've had movies come out, and that is Futurama. It's actually returning to TV next year. I think we reported that before. But it might be without the show's original voice cast, which is going to be really odd. Talks have broken down between 20th Century Fox TV and the stars of the show, Billy West, Katie Sagal, John DiMaggio, Maurice LaMarche, and Tress MacNeille, over how much they should be paid to take part in the show. The studio announced last month that it would produce 26 new episodes of Futurama, and that Comedy Central was on board to begin airing the new episodes in mid-2010. As part of the announcement, the show's producers said stars including West, Seagal, and DiMaggio had all signed on to return. Turns out that wasn't quite true. The stars have all expressed interest in returning, but with the budget for Futurama dramatically slashed, the salary offers came in well below what the actors were asking, and as a result, 20th Century Fox has put out a casting call to find replacement voice actors for the show. It's not the first time 20th Century Fox has gone that route during a tough negotiation on one of its cartoons. The studio previously made a similar move on The Simpsons when it couldn't come to a deal with its stars. Casting feelers were sent out for replacements, but a deal was eventually made with the original cast, obviously. Yeah. The situation is unusual this time around in that 20th Century Fox and Comedy Central have been kicking around ways to make Futurama, originally produced for a broadcast network, the Fox network, make financial sense for a cable run. Obviously, it's going to have a smaller budget when it's on Comedy Central. Yet there's also still a possibility and a window built in for the Futurama to run on a broadcast network first. It's believed that the Futurama cast members were asking for around $75,000 per episode. It was not clear what 20th Century Fox was offering. Calls to the voice stars' reps were not immediately returned. Of course, Futurama originally aired on Fox from 1999 until 2003. The success of the show's repeats on DVD and cable, as well as a series of first-run DVD releases, led to the decision to revive Futurama.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, no kidding. They've had a couple of full-length like DVD movies. Other costs slashed in the process led to a smaller writing staff and a shorter delivery schedule. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. I predict that they're probably going to come to some sort of deal.
Yeah, arbitrator.
Well, not even that far, really. It's a small cast. They have to understand, too, that this is Comedy Central. It's not Fox. Although, I think probably what their representatives are thinking is that it's all the same company. Fox, Comedy Central, they're all part of Viacom.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking that, not Viacom, but yeah, I think they're all part of the same conglomerate. I could be wrong. But they're probably thinking that they have deeper pockets. They just don't want to spend the money. But it's, again, it's Comedy Central. They don't have a huge budget.
Exactly. All right. So last but not least on episode 64 of the show, we've got another record-breaking news story, an overseas one, in that of Transformers Revenge of the Fallen has broken China's box office record with receipts of 400 million yuan. Which is roughly equivalent of $58.5 million U.S., which sank the $52.7 million U.S. record that was held by Titanic since 1998. China film spokesman Wang Li said the Michael Bay movie racked up $44 million in the first 12 days after its release on June 24th. The first installment of the franchise made $37 million in China in 2007. The film was given a wide release on thousands of screens in the absence of any other big movies. China had about 4,100 screens by the end of 2008, and the numbers are growing fast as organizations invest in theaters to feed the growing demand. Locally produced films have started to perform well in recent years, with epics such as John Woo's Red Cliff scoring big money in China. Overall, it's been a good summer for Hollywood, despite the quota system, which means only 20 or so foreign films are released here each year. Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian, which opened on May 26th, became the first overseas film to earn more than 100 million yuan, which is roughly 15 million U.S. at the box office this year in mainland China. That was quickly followed by Terminator Salvation. Ice Age, Dawn of the Dinosaurs, and Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince are still in release. Twilight opens in August, as does Disney Pixar's Up, which is expected to be released on more than 200 3D screens. The way is being cleared for the year's biggest movie in China, The Great Cause of China's Foundation, which is a propaganda extravaganza celebrating October's 60th anniversary of the foundation of the People's Republic of China after the Revolution of 1949.
Sounds riveting. That's actually really interesting. I was surprised to learn that so many, I don't know, maybe this is just, you know, misinformation on my part, or I'm just not keeping up with it, but I'm surprised that so many Western movies actually make it to Japan. I guess, you know, that is true. And
China.
I meant, of course, China. It's interesting. You know, they've got, of course, this propaganda film coming up, but then they've also got a mix of Western films as well.
I'm interested in learning that the theater business is growing big in there. There's a growing demand for movies in China.
You've got John Woo coming back to China and making movies. This Red Cliff, I'd like to see what this is like.
I know there's a lot of censorship and different rules that have to be followed when movies are being released in China. Some movies are just too violent or too demeaning or too sexual that we have here in North America to merit any kind of screening in China. And yet there it is. The demand is growing. I'm sure the Chinese versions, they might be, and this could be ignorance on my part, forgive me. I'm sure they cut down a lot of Terminator Salvation. I'm sure they're going to cut down about a bit of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince just for the sake, for the fact that there's a little bit of grotesqueness, there's a little bit of darkness, and it's, you know, they're not pleasant feeling movies.
I'm sure there are Mandarin and Cantonese translations of the Harry Potter books in mainland China.
Yeah.
I wonder how a movie like Night at the Museum 2 translates. I mean, not actually, you know, language wise, but all the different characters and historical figures that are in Night at the Museum, I wonder how well they're recognized by the Chinese population. You're getting characters like Amelia Earhart and that sort of thing. I mean, if a similar movie were to come here, we've had kind of historical style movies, like Hero and House of Flying Daggers. Those, from what I understand, are mythical, though. They're not, you know, actual historical characters.
The Last Samurai.
Yeah, I wonder if that's the type of thing that they just, you know, just go with flow and don't need a lot of exposition as to who these people are. I wonder, do they get it? Do they understand? I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out exactly what an audience thinks of those types of movies that are kind of centered in American culture and American historical figures, how well they translate overseas. All right. So that should wrap things up for show number 64 of Inside Movies and TV. Thank you very much for listening. Feel free to check out our blog on a regular basis at moviesandtvcast.blogspot.com. And you can email us with questions, comments, kudos, and criticism at moviesandtvcast@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.